one of the real pushes we've been making over the last 18 months or so, actually, with the team already in train here, is to start to move towards much more of a productized technology delivery model. So away from a project orientation, something to much more product-led, persistent teams, stable teams over time, fixed capacity funding, so we can actually start to build capabilities that matter, mature those capabilities, and continue to improve those capabilities.
Welcome to Technovation. I'm your host, Peter High. My guest today is Jonathan Webster. John is the Senior Managing Director and Chief Operating Officer of CPP Investments, a role he's had for roughly a year now. In that role, he oversees the $591 billion Canadian dollar pension fund's technology, data, investment operations, security, and corporate services functions for 22 million contributors and beneficiaries in Canada. He joined CPP Investments from Boston Consulting Group, where he was a managing director and partner, as well as a member of its financial institutions and technology advantage practices. Prior to that, he'd been a chief information officer at Lloyds Banking Group, among other roles that he's held. I look forward to hearing more about his journey and the work that he and his team are doing at CPP Investments. John, welcome to Technovation. It's great to speak with you today.
Oh, great to be here, Peter.
Well, it's a pleasure. John, I wonder if you could take a moment to describe CPP Investments in a bit more detail than I just have. We'd love to understand more about the scale of the operation, as well as how the investments that you focus on inform the technology choices that you make.
CPP Investments, I think, Peter, is one of Canada's most significant success stories. You know, we're a differentiated global investment organization that invests for the next quarter century, not the next quarter, to create retirement security for the future generations of Canadians. And we're a global team. We have about 2,100-ish professionals. And as you said, my role as Chief Operating Officer, together with the COO team, is to really provide the operating platform for the organization, really enabling our investment strategies and accelerating further improvements in our efficiency and effectiveness. And I'd say the sort of overriding dynamic supporting a fund and organization like CPP Investments is the ability to manage diversity. Because we have that diverse nature of investment strategies, you really need to be able to respond to the needs of infrastructure investment strategies through to public market investment strategies, many of which are underpinned by data, some heavily digitized and data-oriented like public markets, others sort of emerging into the sort of digitized arena, classes like infrastructure and real estate still sort of nascent in their digitization. But that diversity is really what you need to support, because the needs of the investment professionals and the supporting teams are very different across those asset classes. You also need to be able to really bring together a holistic portfolio view of the organization. So if you think about the things that we actually do, we make large sort of macro allocation decisions in terms of where we will allocate capital from a global perspective in terms of geographies and sectors. You need to be able to look at that allocation globally. We need to think about the risk of how we're allocated globally. But we also need to make a lot of investment selection decisions, you know, within markets, within particular strategies. So the ability to have the diversity, but also roll up and look at the portfolio in many dimensions is what really puts the sort of test on the infrastructure, the architecture, and technology and data.
And how did the opportunity to join CPP Investments occur to you, John? You are not a Canadian. You're not based in Canada even, though you were there not only today, but often. Talk a bit about how they found you or how you found them.
I've been very fortunate to sort of both have client-side roles. You mentioned my role at Lloyds Banking Group. Actually, my career path has been into consulting, into line and operator roles, back into consulting, and then back into now sort of line and operator role. And I really enjoy that variety. I think the opportunity to both be able to step back, think strategically when you're in working with clients as an advisor, but also actually be in the mix of the melee when you're working on the operator side. And as I made the decision to sort of move back onto the operator side, I was really looking for an organization where, you know, you had a real opportunity to drive with purpose. So there's a real anchor around the purpose. And I think that's frankly just important for myself and actually for teams to really galvanize your efforts around. I wanted somewhere where you could really feel like you could affect change. And I've been a CIO in a very large bank, a really satisfying role, but one where very large organizations that, you know, can take time to move and adjust and sort of pick up new technology. We are at CPP Investments large in assets under management, but we're relatively small as an organization. And I think that ability of having real impact, but being able to move and make changes, meaningful changes that improve the way we operate in a smaller organization was something I was looking for. So I was fortunate that the opportunity for the COO role at CPP Investments came up as I was looking, and it was just, frankly, a match made in heaven.
I mentioned at the top, John, a portion of your responsibilities are over data for the organization as well. And you alluded to some of that in terms of some of the changes you and the team have been focused on. Your term, the past year, term and role so far, has certainly coincided with remarkable change, generally speaking, in the landscape with regard to the ability to process data now with advances, further advances in artificial intelligence, generative artificial intelligence, and the like. Talk a bit about how the evolution of data and analytics have impacted the work that you and your team are doing.
I mean, I think maybe I'll start actually a little bit with getting the foundations right, Peter, because I think that's I think that's really, really important. So one of the real pushes we've been making over the last year or so, maybe the last 18 months or so, actually, with the team already in train here, is to start to move towards much more of a productized technology delivery model. So away from a project orientation, something to much more product-led, persistent teams, stable teams over time, fixed capacity funding, so we can actually start to build capabilities that matter, mature those capabilities, and continue to improve those capabilities. And that's been one of the foundational things to really make sure that we can connect technology, frankly, to value. Because, you know, whilst data is really important, that's not the only thing that goes into the mix in terms of creating value. And I think creating, you know, connecting technology to the people that can really do something valuable with it is, I think, a foundational part of operating a technology function well. So one of the sort of foundational shifts we've been making is that project to product shift to really connect technology to the product owners and the teams that can create value with it. So that's one of the foundational parts. And the second foundational part is to really drive towards a much more modularized architecture. And I think that's certainly in an institutional investing, there's a sort of dominant design pattern of very sort of front to back integrated systems. They're not the sorts of platforms you would find in, for example, consumer businesses or retail banking or, you know, commercial banking businesses, where the architecture has evolved quite substantially over the last 10 or 15 years, under direct customer pressure to be able to respond more quickly, make things accessible, to be able to personalize. So we've been driving towards modularizing our architecture. I think those are two really foundational parts to getting actually the leverage of data really well. Because once you are, you know, connecting people to the technology that they can do something valuable with, and you've got a modular, responsive, nimble architecture, then you can start to sort of pull data from different systems, different platforms, liberate the data, and start to do, I think, interesting value creation things with it. I think generative AI has been a real step change, I think, in the ability to democratize technology over the last 12 months. I'm actually very bullish on generative AI. I think I often say to people in the organization, you know, one of the things we do a lot of is talk to people, legal people, tax people, investment professionals, technology people. I think generative AI, large language models, unlock capabilities that allow us to change the nature of our interactions, change the nature of how we interact with intelligence. And I think unlocking our data, now that we've sort of productized and started to modularize, is starting to show real opportunity. So, you know, we've already got very broad access to generative AI capabilities across the organization and have very targeted, select value creation opportunities in particular investment strategies and in particular areas. I think there's plenty more to come. I'm excited to see what 2024 brings in terms of, you know, foundational capabilities that are coming out, but we're trying to make progress here, leveraging what's there already.
Yeah. And talk a bit about how you organize your team and how that team, a global one, collaborates in a way that makes it effective.
Focus on capabilities that can be leveraged enterprise-wide. So I think you do want to build capabilities where the whole organization can benefit from them. If you think about what we, you know, as a global organization, it's really important to have a single view of our relationships with our partners. So having, you know, enterprise-wide CRM systems, you know, pipeline systems, making sure we're understanding, you know, all the interactions around our partners and how deals move through their life cycle, having that consistent integrated view, I think is really, really important. And I think that goes through, you know, the investment life cycle, everything from, you know, as you start to think about sourcing, investment opportunities, all the way through to sort of post deal and the life cycle that happens in terms of cash movements. I think you do want to leverage that scale and have enterprise-wide capabilities. But I think in a global organization, you also really need to connect technology, frankly, at the front line to the everyday user. And I think if you sit too distant and only think about the enterprise capabilities, I think you miss real opportunities to connect people to everyday value creation opportunities. So You know, if you are in an infrastructure investment analyst, you know, you run very large Excel models, very complicated models about, you know, cash flow forecasts for complicated infrastructure investments. These things can take a lot of time to run. The everyday desktop experience can be actually quite frustrating. And if you aren't connecting to that local nuance, understanding the needs of users on the desktop, you're missing an opportunity to get people encouraged by technology and getting them adopting it. So I think you have to run a global set of enterprise capabilities, but stay really connected to the local user needs. And that's been a big thrust for us, actually. One of the shifts we're making in our architecture principles, actually, I mentioned modularization, which I think is a strategic choice. I think you can choose to be a very modularized architecture. You can be a very integrated sort of front to back architecture. Saying for us, modularization is a strategic choice. There are alternatives to being modularized. I think being user centric, I don't think that's a strategic choice. I think that's just a necessity. I think, you know, the opposite of not being user centric is being unuser centric. And I think, you know, one of the fundamental imperatives, I think, of getting technology right with colleagues is to really take that user needs perspective. And I think the combination of global and local is really important.
So clearly by being global and being able to sit with the intended users of the technology, you gain special insights as to their uses. And I wonder, you know, what are some of the things that you are learning as a result of those deeper collaborations in terms of the evolving needs that people have in the use of technology and how that's helped you formulate your plans to serve them better?
I'll use an example, actually. I think generative AI is a really good example. I think, you know, we've made a deliberate decision to start with very hands-on experience in actually one of our global offices and to really concentrate getting every user in that global office 2 or 3 hours of hands-on facilitated experience with tools like Microsoft Copilot, our own internal GPT-4 based platforms. Because one of the things we found is, I think generative AI is a very different type of technology. I really do think it's a sort of step change from things we've seen in the past. I think, you know, when you had flavors of different programming languages, you could get to grips with them. You knew what they did do and you knew what they couldn't do. And I think what we're finding with generative AI at the moment is it can do some stuff, and then, you know, maybe it lets you down on some stuff, and then maybe it exceeds your expectations on some other things. And we're finding that colleagues who really stick with using generative AI based tools need to pass a sort of 2 or 3 hour bar of really immersive usage with it before they get comfortable to say, actually, I'm fine to start to discover what works and what doesn't work. I think when we've seen colleagues engage, you know, for 25, 30 minutes, they try something, it doesn't quite sort of meet the needs, it's a little bit disappointing off the bat. There's a danger of giving up on generative AI. And I think, you know, we're big fans of Ethan Mollick here. If you're familiar with Ethan Mollick, who sort of talks a lot about generative AI on his podcast, Professor from Wharton. And he says, you need 10 hours with a GPT-4 class model before you really start to believe that generative AI can do something for you. So one of the things we're doing very specifically is sort of taking one of our global offices, really encouraging users and facilitating colleagues to get those 2 or 3 hours to get onto the on-ramp of using generative AI so that they can move to the 10 hours. And then it starts to feel like it's a really sticky affair. And that's the sort of thing where I think you've got to be really immersive and engaged with your colleagues across the organization.
Very interesting, John. Well, in light of the advancements that you have made and the amount of data that flows through your systems, it makes me think a little bit about another area of responsibility of yours, which is security. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the way in which you manage security in an organization like yours, given the remarkable amount of data that flows through your systems and the importance of it.
I think the heart of good security is getting people to take it seriously. And people are a huge, huge part of that. And that product model, I think, really anchors us into, you know, a very effective way of just having a whole broad set of considerations taken into account by our teams developing their capabilities. I think the second piece, which is really important to us, and frankly, a real advantage, is we're largely software defined. So we made the move to the cloud 2019. It was a very rapid move to the cloud. We have very little on-premise left. Of course, we have SaaS solutions, but the vast majority of our built software is all built on public cloud. And being software defined really allows us to be very effective in our secure by design principles. So we are able to embed security checking, vulnerability checking, vulnerability scanning, you know, within our pipelines to make sure that our software development is, you know, sound and secure from the outset. So, you know, again, second part being secure by design is, I think, to be software defined and really build it in as a sort of primary concern as you're developing your software and your platforms. I think the third piece, which is super important, is to just have that in a much broader context where you're thinking about the full life cycle of security. Now, we're fortunate that we've got deep intelligence expertise within the organization. So everything from our threat intelligence, how we think about the world, the threats we need to consider, you know, all the way through to the expertise in our, you know, security operations, you know, all of that software development, that whole product thinking, security is the first cloud concern embedded in a full life cycle perspective. Now, you can never take anything for granted with security. So I think you've got to continue to, you know, up your game. The world gets more complicated, threat actors get more, you know, ambitious. So we don't take anything for granted. But I think we have some good foundations in the people, the working practices, our software engineering practices, you know, and the frame of a real intelligence-led perspective that we put all of that in.
Yeah, very interesting overview. I appreciate you sharing all of the above. You mentioned earlier, John, that yours has been a career that has been in industry, for a lack of a better way of framing it, then to consulting and back, and a few different pogo bounces from one to the other. And including time as a chief information officer, the rare distinction of having been a partner at both at McKinsey and at BCG. I wonder if you could talk a bit about the advantages, whether planned or simply an outcome of the way in which your career has unfolded, and how your periods as first your period as a CIO has contributed to your technology, especially responsibilities today, but also how time spent as a consultant has enriched your periods when you've been in operational roles.
I'd love to say that, you know, everything was planned with great foresight and forethought. I don't think that was true. I think one thing I have tried to do as I've gone through my career is think about, you know, how one role positions you and gives you optionality to take on, you know, interesting roles that play to your strengths over time. So that is something that I think has been deliberate. You know, my first industry role, which was with Lloyds Banking Group, was to take on the digital COO as Lloyds set up what was then probably the sort of the first digital division of a major bank in the UK. And that was, you know, and the point of that was to really concentrate the digital efforts across the organization, really act as the accelerator for digitization sort of back in 2013 and 2014. And sort of just being in that, you know, that first digital COO role was actually pretty formative for me. It was the first time I'd sort of stepped in and had to think about not just developing something, but the ongoing run, evolution, curation, you know, making something that was built and was built to last and evolve over time was a new experience for me. And I think that's where I started to really think about, you know, how you set up an organization that can't just sort of build things and pop them out in the world, but actually can sort of build, evolve, you know, take a more product-oriented mindset to things. As I moved through Lloyds Banking Group, I mean, the second role I took on was the CIO role for digital and transformation, which was a team of about 1,500 to 2,000 people across the organization. That was the role, frankly, where I realized you sort of had to give some things up in order to be effective. I remember moving from running a team of a few hundred people as the digital COO to moving to running a team of 1,500 people as digital CIO. And I think within the first 3 months, I realized, candidly, I don't know what's going on. I can't know what's going on. There are 1,500 people doing all forms of product development, system development, putting things out to our customers. You know, at that point, we had sort of 15 million digital customers. Biggest digital bank in the UK, maybe 50% of the sales of the bank going through, you know, the digital platforms that I was responsible for. And you sort of have this uncomfortable feeling where I can't actually know what's going on across 1,500 people on an ongoing basis. And so where do you spend your time? You spend your time trying to make sure you're setting up the organization, the context, that all those teams can be effective and productive. And I think that was the sort of formative moment for me where I started to learn that making a context in which high-performing teams, you know, many high-performing teams could be high-performing, was a really important part of the sort of executive role. I then moved to BCG and a little bit around to McKinsey and back to BCG. And that was the place, candidly, where I learned that the nature of effective executive conversations. You know, I think those organizations are... Actually, one of my mentors at BCG used to say, you know, all we do, John, is talk to people, so we had better get good at talking to people. And it sounds like a trite statement, but so much of what we do to make progress in the world is to have discussions, you know, make clear our points of view, you know, discuss and debate our points of view, what's our logic of the situation, how should we move forward? And doing that in a really effective fashion, I think, can make the real difference between, you know, high-performing organizations and organizations that can't make progress. And then I've been able to bring a lot of that together at CPP Investments. That sort of that product orientation, if you like, the belief that one of your roles is to create a context in which great teams can just be great, and many great teams can just be many great teams. And then the ability to sort of, I think, bring together an effective executive conversation so it makes sure we're moving in the right direction. I'm not sure I planned it that way, but I was fortunate that as I went through the journey, I felt like I was developing some skills that gave me an opportunity at least to have a go at being an effective COO.
Are there, as you're reflecting upon your career journey, any other secrets to your ascent, to your having ended up in now multiple consequential roles, things that you're glad you did that have served you well in retrospect?
I think curiosity, Peter, is important. I think you'll be curious about the world. I read avidly. I mean, many people read avidly, but I think you've got to wonder where the world's going, because a lot of what we do, strategy is about choice making and creating new possibilities. So you can't be passive in the world if you're going to try and make progress. You've got to do something different than otherwise would have happened unless you'd chosen to act in that way. So I think curiosity sort of underpins actually strategy and possibility making. The second thing I've learned over time is I've never taken enough time to understand anything. I think whenever I've, something's been complicated and you're in discussions with colleagues or peers or partners and you're feeling like you're not making progress, often it's just because you haven't taken enough time to understand somebody else's perspective. I think people who can really take the time to understand the perspectives of the people around them, the world around them, you have a much better chance of making progress in the world. And I think you need to be dissatisfied. You need to come with a little bit of a sense of dissatisfaction with the everyday. You want to walk in thinking, we can be better at this. I think you've got to feel like you're always raising the bar on yourself, I think is the most important bar to raise. But I think you want to be feeling like you're raising the bar on the team so people have something new and different to aspire to. I think somewhere underneath that is a sort of dissatisfaction with the world as it is, but in a good way, in a way of wanting to create some new possibilities.
Great answers all. Well, we've certainly talked about a number of important trends, perhaps chief among those, artificial intelligence and Gen AI. Any other trends, business, technology, people, however you choose to interpret that, any other trends as you look to the future that have you particularly excited, John?
I'm genuinely very excited by generative AI. I know we've talked about it already, but I do think the possibilities of growing very different technology experiences with generative AI are starting to appear. One of the thought experiments I do with the team here, and we're going to hopefully start some work on this soon, is almost confine yourself to ChatGPT 4, confine yourself to only using AI agents. How would you change the way you do your work today? If that were they were the only two things you had at your disposal, how would you sort of grow a new experience of how you do your work? Yeah, what would that look like? And I think that's a real fascinating, not just a thought experiment, I think experiment that I think almost every organization can run almost in every part of the work that they do. I really do see work really reconfiguring. I think, when I look at what we do in most organizations, a lot of the structure we have is driven really from two things. One is trying to bring people together at a point in time to collaborate. You think about you need to bring tax expertise in, investment expertise in, legal expertise in. A lot of the structure is about choreographing, getting all that expertise together at the same point in time. And then the other part of that structure is about really evidence and control, that you've made some, meaningful step along the way. There's a point in time where you've made a decision and then you move on. Actually, we live in a really unstructured world. If you think about what we do at work, we take unstructured human conversations, we try and structure the world in all sorts of systems and platforms, then we come back out to some sort of moment where we have an unstructured conversation, we make a decision, we move on to the next thing. And a lot of our structure is just to facilitate great conversations. What I'm so excited about generative AI is I think it just gives us a different way of doing that. And I love the idea of just starting to grow new and different experiences of interacting with intelligence. Sit yourself in front of ChatGPT, have an agent architecture. That's the only two things you've got at your disposal. What would you grow as an experience instead? I'm super excited about that.
Well, John Webster, thank you so much for a terrific conversation covering your year-long tenure at CPP Investments and some of the remarkable work that you and your team are doing, but also reflections from across your remarkable career. It's been a great conversation. Thank you again.
Well, thank you, Peter. Thanks for the invite.